This is Charlotte Talks. I'm David Borax in for Mike Collins. It's been a dreary year for the nuclear power industry, especially here in the Southeast. In March, a key contractor filed for bankruptcy. Westinghouse Electric designed the AR-1000 reactor, which was supposed to be at the center of a new generation of nuclear power plants around the Southeast. One of those was in South Carolina. Utilities Santee Cooper and South Carolina Electric and Gas were adding two reactors at the VC Summer plant north of Columbia. But the project was over budget and behind schedule. In July, Santee Cooper's board decided to abandon the project. Then SCE&G quit too. Here's how CEO Kevin Marsh of SCE&G's parent, Scana, explained it to Wall Street analysts.
SCE&G concluded it would not be in the best interest of its customers and other stakeholders to continue construction of the project on its own. In an effort to consider all possible avenues, we reached out to other potential partners and pursued governmental support. Neither of those efforts has been successful. As a result, SCE&G will cease construction of both new nuclear units.
Now, Duke Energy is calling it quits on two projects that were licensed but not started yet, one in South Carolina and one in Florida. In Georgia, the fate of the Southern Company's Vogtle plant has also been up in the air. Last week, the company decided to finish it, but it will cost billions of dollars more than expected. That makes it the only nuclear plant under construction in the U.S. right now.
What does all this mean for the future of the nuclear industry in the U.S.? With me to talk about this on Charlotte Talks today are Scott Batson, Senior Vice President for Nuclear Operations at Duke Energy, with me here in the WFAE studio. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
Kit Connellidge, the Senior Utilities Industry Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, on the line from New York. Hello, Kit.
Hello.
Sarah Barzak is the High-Risk Energy Choices Program Director at the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. She's with us by Skype.
Hello. Thank you.
And we've got Avery Wilkes, a reporter from the state newspaper, joining us by phone from Columbia, South Carolina. I wanted to start with you, Avery. Let's start with the VC Summer project. Big picture here, what led up to the collapse of this project? Was this a surprise?
I think for many people, just the average person here in Columbia, it was a shock. For people who have been following the situation closely, not as much. You know, what led up to this were, for one, in 2007, the Baseload Review Act's passage, that law that clearly favored utilities and shifted the, you know, the risk of starting a project of this magnitude from the utilities themselves to their ratepayers, really paved the way for all of this. And once that was passed, it was clear that this was going to get started. But then you had years of construction delays and cost overruns, and you know, some testimony before state boards about you know, how things were just not getting done at this site. And ultimately, the bankruptcy of Westinghouse was what set all of this in motion. You know, and now, you know, on July 31st, you've got the two utilities saying that they're going to abandon the project.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk some more about the cost overruns and that sort of thing a bit later. But what has the fallout been from this? I know there have been layoffs. There have been discussions at the legislature. What are some of the issues that you've seen as far as fallout?
Immediately, about 5,000 employees lost their jobs. I believe they were returning from a lunch break, and you know, there were security guards at the door, and they were being told to pack up their things and leave that day. I believe that was on a Monday. Then immediately you had lawmakers who were calling press conferences, or there was an energy caucus formed, and you know, a ton of members of the General Assembly joined that. I'm not sure if there's anything been done from that caucus at this point, but both the House and the Senate convened special committees to study what went wrong, to make recommendations. Those committees look to be at least partially trying to figure out who should be blamed for this, or who the responsibility ultimately lays with, but also to look at what went wrong in the regulatory structure within the state of South Carolina that led to this, from the Baseload Review Act, which I mentioned earlier, the 2007 law that enabled all this, to various state boards and the lawmakers that appoint them that approved this project without really very much detail or you know, very detailed construction timelines or cost estimates. I think it's safe to say, and lawmakers have said so far, that the blame lies on a lot of different parties. But so far there have been just a whole lot of tension. It's safe to call this a political firestorm a lot of fingers being pointed in a lot of different directions. You know, already the House Speaker has called for the resignation of the Office of Regulatory Staff Director. That's the state agency that advises the Public Service Commission, which is the state board that approved all of the rate increases to pay for the project as well as the project itself. The governor has refused to accept that resignation, which hasn't been offered. But so there's been a lot of tension on all sides on what heads should roll, who should take the blame, and what should be done going forward.
Kit Connellage, let's zoom back out a bit. What does the VC summer project collapse mean for the nuclear industry?
Well, it's bad news. That's pretty straightforward. I think that the utility industry overall has been looking to these two major projects, the Summer Project and the Vogtle Project, as the potential indicators for whether nuclear is going to be viable in the future. And I'd say at this point, people, for the time being, at any rate, are concluding that it will not be a likely source of new power plant construction anytime in the near future. I should point out that the biggest swing factor probably in over the 10 years or so that these projects have been under consideration and then in construction, the biggest single swing factor has been that natural gas prices have dropped sharply. So that very significant alternative source of power, natural gas, just got much cheaper. So that makes nuclear that much more expensive. It was expensive to begin with, but at least in the past you said, well, over the 40-year life of these plants, you have a lot of stability and visibility on how much it's going to cost, so you're hedging against the potential for a lot of fluctuation in fuel prices for customers. With gas prices so low, it gets harder and harder for people to make that argument.
And then another factor here is renewable energy, wind and solar, which wasn't even on the radar screen when any of these plants were being planned and built, and now that's a factor.
Yeah, no question about it. There's certainly more solar in particular in the Southeast and more coming. And I think we should also mention that after 2008, the financial crisis, the demand for electricity never bounced back the way it has after past recessions. And people attribute that as of now. The thinking is that that's due to a lot of the efficiencies that have got into the system. So less demand for electricity, less need for new power plants, less need for expensive power plants like nuclear.
Right. Well, the summer plant in South Carolina wasn't the only one canceled recently. It's a little bit different because these had not started yet. But Scott Batson of Duke Energy, Duke has decided in the past couple of weeks not to build the Levy plant in Florida and the Lee plant in South Carolina. What went into Duke's decision on those two projects? Was it costs, energy demand, Westinghouse?
It was many factors. The energy demand is something that we constantly monitor in terms of the need for new generation. And we consider all sources of generation when we're looking at that in terms of future energy demand. In terms of the cancellation of those specific projects at VC Summer and how that impacted Duke, I would tell you that these evaluations were already underway in terms of the future of those projects. The Levy project in Florida has been abandoned. We will not maintain the combined construction and operating license for that facility, which Duke did receive. So we won't spend any additional funds in maintaining that license and keeping it as an option for future construction. Different from that, with the Lee facility that was proposed, the term that we used is cancel the project, but we will maintain that combined operating construction and operating license as an option for a new power plant in the future.
Keeping the door open there.
Yes, we are.
Okay. I want to bring Sarah Barsack into the conversation. She's with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Tell us a little bit about your group and why have you opposed new nuclear projects like these?
Sure, and thank you for being here. Thank you to the fellow panelists as well. I really appreciate it. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, we were founded back in 1985. We're a nonprofit organization, and we promote responsible energy choices that work to address the impacts of global climate change and ensure clean, safe, and healthy communities throughout the Southeast. We essentially work on all aspects of energy policy with a particular focus on the electricity sector. And so quite a long time ago, I was brought on board back in 1999, so I have a lot of historical knowledge with this. We were involved and concerned about carbon emissions and climate change. Global warming was more the term used back then, and the focus was more on coal plants and cleaning up coal plants and things like that. And what we looked at organizationally, because in the Southeast we have a reliance on nuclear power plants, we have quite a number in the region, and there was talk about potentially more nuclear coming out, and then that was born out of some federal policy initiatives that happened in the 2002 to the 2005 timeframe with the Energy Policy Act of 2003 and 2005. And we saw, you know, this rush, so to speak, this race by almost all the utilities in our Southeast region putting in applications with public service commissions or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to potentially pursue new reactor technology. And because we are concerned about climate emissions and carbon emissions, we needed to look at what were solutions for the Southeastern region. And through a lot of soul searching and deep research, we looked at what the costs were for, you know, really ramping up nuclear in the Southeast and how that could affect carbon emissions. And the long and short is we came to the determination that it would take too much money to build enough nuclear to make a difference in terms of reducing carbon emissions, and that it was a very risky choice for utilities and for the region. And so we engaged all over the Southeast in these different regulatory arenas at the federal and state level. And one of the speakers earlier talked about, you know, the drop in natural gas prices, the growth in renewables. We were testifying to that with expert witnesses mm-hmm. in Florida, in Georgia, in the Carolinas, that growth projections were too high, that the cost estimates that utilities were putting out for new nuclear were too low, and that the timelines to actually build these things were quite speedy, very quick, much quicker than what the industry had really experienced before.
So these weren't going to be the solution that people thought they were. I mean, a decade ago, when a lot of these plants that are under construction or planned right now were starting to be talked about, you know, it was going to be a solution to the climate change issue. But then in 2011, Fukushima happened, the meltdown at the Japanese reactor, and that kind of threw a monkey wrench into all of this. Let me ask you about quickly, we've got just about 30 seconds here. What about environmental issues with these plants?
Well, one of the top tier issues that we've been concerned about and is sort of an Achilles heel for the electricity sector, particularly in the Southeast, is water. Coal plants, nuclear plants in particular, need quite a bit of water. And as you're looking at climate change impacts, you know, potentially longer droughts, more severe droughts, that type of thing, you have competition between water users. And nuclear is a water hog. It requires a tremendous amount of water. And it also, you know, emits contaminants and thermal pollution, hotter water into waterways.
Sarah, we can come back to the environmental issues in just a second. We need to take a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
More of our encore conversation on the nuclear industry coming up in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support today comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Radiology, the imaging expert since 1967, celebrating 50 years of subspecialized radiology care. And from Treetops by Lennar, a private, gated, active adult community offering resort-style amenities and Lennar's Everything's Included homes. Details at lennar.com/treetops. It's primary election day in Charlotte. Polls are open until 7:30 this evening. After the votes for mayor and city council are tallied, tomorrow on Charlotte Talks we'll have results and analysis. Then a conversation on Southern cuisine and how it crosses races, genders, and classes. What does what we eat say about us? Food writers will pull up a seat at the table with Mike Collins tomorrow morning on Charlotte Talks at 9 o'clock on listener-supported public radio 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the huge hack at Equifax. Millions of Americans' most sensitive personal information now out there for sale to thieves or governments. What do we do to fix this? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm David Borax in for Mike Collins. We're talking today about the future of the nuclear industry after the cancellation of major projects here in the Southeast, including two planned by Duke Energy. I want to go back to you, Avery Wilkes, and ask you, is there any chance that the summer project will be revived? South Carolina's Governor Henry McMaster has said they were hunting around for partners to help complete that one.
Sure, that's a good question. I think that's one that a lot of reporters around here are trying to answer. Initially, I think a lot of people would have said no. In investor calls, SCANA, South Carolina Electric and Gas, is a parent company, they've made it seem very doubtful. Santee Cooper executives also have made it seem very doubtful. More recently, it's come out that Governor Henry McMaster has formed a small task force of folks who are very close to this project or very close to the situation, who are negotiating with some unknown number of utilities or interested parties who could potentially buy all of SCANA, part of SCANA, or potentially buy into the buy into an ownership stake for the project to revive it. It's unclear whether what the chances are that will be successful or what form that kind of agreement might take.
Right.
But while as I talked about earlier, while the House and while the Senate have formed these committees to investigate what went wrong and what could be done moving forward, the governor is really taking a completely separate track altogether, and he's working really hard, apparently daily, to try to negotiate with some of these companies, high-level Fortune 500, Fortune 200 companies, to try to get them involved in some way to get some value out of the project.
You know, one of those companies whose name has been mentioned is Duke Energy. Scott, what does Duke say about joining the summer project?
Well, Duke has done a review of the summer project, the current situation with the cost that has been invested into the facility, looked at projections in terms of what it would take to complete the project, also in terms of cost, and then also the schedule and the schedule delays that have occurred. At this point, based on the information that Duke has been has available to them, independent of the panel and what the governor is doing, we did not see that as a wise investment or a wise path for Duke to take in terms of that particular project, just to take over the project in some form as an independent company.
Go ahead.
The when you look at what it would take for Duke in terms of additional investment, both for us as a company and then also for our customers, we just did not see that it was feasible to do at this point.
That sounds a lot like the kind of things that Kevin Marsh, the CEO of SCANA, was saying in one of his conference calls recently with Wall Street analysts. He basically poured cold water on the idea that that they might be able to revive this. I suppose it's out there, but Kit Connellage, what are you hearing about the possibility that this plant may not be dead?
Obviously, we read the same things and listen to the same things that a lot of other people are doing, including what Duke is saying and SCANA. And I would say the general feeling among the investor community is that it's unlikely that somebody will come along and, in effect, bail out the project for the reasons that Duke has mentioned, that it is hard to, given how long it would take, how much money it might take. I think the biggest thing with investors for a lot of these projects is just that the open-ended nature of the construction. The history has been that it's very hard to have a lot of comfort in deadlines that your contractor gives you, and obviously, they're extremely complex projects, and so the potential for many billions of dollars to go into them without a lot of conviction on when they'd be done and for what price, I think has a lot of people, you know, very concerned that they would want to get into a project like that.
Avery, back to you just quickly here. I want to talk about how the summer project got paid for, and this is going back to your allusion earlier to the 2007 law, which allows the utilities to charge customers up front for the construction, and that's even if the project isn't completed, right? Where did that law come from, and where does it stand right now?
So the law is still in place. It's called the Baseload Review Act. It was pushed through extremely quickly. When I look back at some of the records, about as quickly as I've seen any legislation that wasn't some sort of meaningless resolution get pushed through. I think it was introduced first in February, and it was law by May the 3rd. And that is just extremely fast for the pace that this legislature works at. It was virtually unopposed. In the Senate, it had 25 co-sponsors out of 46 total senators, and we didn't have on the record voting at that point, but records indicate that it received at least one unanimous vote to get out of the Senate. In the House, it was passed about 104-6, somewhere in that range, and wasn't actually considered in a House committee, the Senate version of the bill. So it went straight to the House and was passed out. It was heavily backed by utilities, SCANA in particular, and actually was written with heavy input from SE&G and SCANA's attorney.
So that is, and it's allowed these utilities to spend about $9 billion on this plant so far. And now the utilities legislators are saying maybe we don't need this. Do you think it will be repealed?
I'm not sure whether repeal is the right word, but it will certainly, there have already been efforts even going back to this spring to amend certain parts of the language to try to look out better for ratepayers than lawmakers believe that the Baseload Review Act did. Currently, the opinion about the Baseload Review Act is that it completely absolved the utilities of any real responsibility or any incentive to get the project completed on time. When it insulated them from risk and actually ensured that they would, still reap profits from a project even if it failed. So there have been efforts already underway to amend some of the language in that law to better protect ratepayers.
Of that $9 billion, they still have hundreds of millions of dollars that they haven't recovered, and then there's the cost of shutting down the project. Will that be something that winds up on the shoulders of ratepayers?
Potentially. I believe SE&G in some calls has already presented plans, and actually I believe in their petition to the Public Service Commission for abandonment, they have presented plans to recover another $2.2 billion or so from South Carolina ratepayers just to shut down the project and to cover the rest of their costs. Currently, I think that's under negotiation. Some lawmakers will obviously want to see that number far lower. And we'll probably look to decrease the rate of return on equity for this project, which is currently at about 10.25%, as a way to help make sure that the ratepayers aren't totally left on the hook.
Actually, let's just take a minute, and can you explain that return on equity for people who may not be familiar with the way the regulated utility monopolies work?
Sure. So currently with this project and the way that it was set up and approved, SE&G is guaranteed a 10.25% return profit, essentially, for this project, regardless of whether the project fails, succeeds, whatever. That's what the company's shareholders and the company itself are guaranteed. So there will be an effort, and it's already underfoot, to try to renegotiate that, to potentially get it as low to zero as possible. At certain points during this process, some private interveners, conservationists, the SE Small Business Council have already opposed certain rate increases and gotten that dropped down from 10.5 to 10.25, and even that was a huge deal. So I think it would be shocking if there was not an effort to try to drop that number even further.
Sarah, let me ask you about this. You know, you mentioned earlier the concern about costs and ratepayers. What are your concerns about how this project will affect the people who are buying electricity?
Well, the VC Summer Project has already impacted the rates of SCE&G customers and Santee Cooper customers. And in follow-up to some of the comments earlier, especially with the governor of South Carolina's, you know, dogged attempt to potentially resurrect this project, you have to ask, at what cost? I mean, Santee Cooper testified to the legislature, the state legislature, that they would have a 41% projected rate increase if they went forward with both units. And that essentially there was a 75% increase in the cost to that project for Santee Cooper. And SCE&G also testified to extreme rate impacts to their customers. So, you know, unfortunately, and in all these states, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, that have these pay in advance laws at the state level, customers are on the hook regardless of whether they get abandoned or not. And so they're suffering. And, you know, the legislature needs to look at themselves and their role in this debacle and figure out the best ways to fix it ASAP, because people already have rate impacts in South Carolina that I would argue are almost unbearable already. And there's more to come.
Let me ask you, Scott, in the case of Duke Energy's two project cancellations, how is Duke paying for those?
So first of all, in terms of how Duke is paying for those, as far as the Levy project, there was expenses associated with it, using the cost recovery option that we've talked about. A percentage of that has been recovered in Florida, $870 million recovered. We are not pursuing any additional reimbursement for the expense associated with the development of that project and pursuing the combined operating and construction and operating license.
I think that's $150 million, right?
$150
million that Duke is going to forego.
That's correct. It's approximately $150 million. In North Carolina, we have just as of August 25th filed with our rate case request reimbursement for the cost associated with the Lee plant, and we will be doing that also for in the state of South Carolina for reimbursement. The total expense for the Lee plant is $542 million to date.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Just in terms of the impact to customers. You know, Duke's approach, as we looked at these projects, we have to ensure that we have a long-term source of reliable electricity to all of our customers. We've talked about different forms of generation. Nuclear was one and is one that we continue to support. In terms of the challenges currently in the area of nuclear, we made the decisions that we've talked about previously in your show. I think something that's very important that we have to look at, both in terms of for Duke as a utility, other utilities, the region, the state, and even at the national level, is that there's risk associated with all forms of generation in terms of volatility changes and the ability of those generation sources to provide that reliable source of electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so diversity is very important, and we have to make sure that we maintain a diverse source of generation. We do believe that nuclear is an important part of that. Currently, it provides, between 50 and 60% of the electricity for our service territory.
And that's here in the Carolinas.
That's here in the Carolinas. And in terms of the cost associated with it, if you look back over the history of nuclear, nuclear's cost has remained relatively constant, where you've seen volatility in other sources of generation. So there's both the cost volatility and in terms of the availability of the energy. If you look at the capacity factors or the availability of, say, solar, that's on the magnitude order of 20 to 30% availability to provide the electricity that our customers need. Nuclear is greater than 90%. Mm-hmm. So it's a balance in terms of just managing that diversity.
You and everybody that I talk about that as one of the key things about solar. But can you just give us a quick headline on the where nuclear fits into the mix at Duke Energy right now? What are the other Yes. Sources that you use.
Yes, I'd be glad to. Nuclear, I've spoken to it. We still do have some coal-fired facilities. We have retired a number of those, and we're working to, as far as those that remain in service, we have done modifications to those to reduce the carbon footprint associated with those. We also have 20 wind facilities across the United States, 60 solar facilities, 35 of those in North Carolina. North Carolina is number two in the nation for solar. We've just announced 700 megawatts of new solar in Florida, and that will be coming online in the next 10 years. And then also beyond that, we have the gas, and then we have hydro. We have 300 additional megawatts that will be coming online from our Bag Creek pump storage facility.
Mm-hmm. Well, these nuclear plants that you were mentioning were built 30, 40 years ago or more. I think the average age in the U.S. is 35 years. This will be an issue all across the U.S. They're running on old technology, and their licenses are coming to an end. What happens to Duke after those licenses expire and you lose that 50 to 60% of your generation?
That's why it's important that we continue to maintain these options open. It's not just for Duke. It's across the entire United States. We are dependent upon nuclear providing a significant amount of our baseload generation. So in terms of the nuclear units, we're currently with the 11 nuclear units that Duke operates. They're in the first 20 years for initial license extension beyond their original license. Those licenses will expire beginning in 2030. And so we're looking forward beyond 2030 about options. There are options. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has endorsed an approach to go for a subsequent license renewal. And so when Duke looks at the options of new construction in terms of nuclear or extending those licenses for another 20 years to provide that reliable, constant source of baseload generation that we all depend upon, the 20-year license extension, it looks very favorable to Duke, and we believe all of our facilities are capable of achieving that 20-year license extension.
Okay. Sarah, what's your take on the future of nuclear versus other kinds of generation in the mix?
Well, the future is not nuclear, obviously, anytime soon, given what has happened. There were over 30 reactors proposed about a decade ago, and really only two remain, and those are the Vogtle reactors that are under construction. Duke, we reaching a settlement with them in Florida. We applaud them in Duke Energy Florida for, you know, proactively sort of moving the 21st century energy structure forward and embracing smart technologies, as was pointed out, with battery storage, energy storage, solar, and renewables. Those are growing worldwide. The Southeast in particular has tremendous opportunity to grow in those areas. And, there's also support, very broad support for renewables by community members. And I think that's going to be very important moving forward in the Southeast, because obviously ratepayers are paying for something in some of these states that never happened with these nuclear debacles. So money is limited in people's pockets, and we have to make really smart, wise, efficient decisions with limited dollars.
Mm-hmm. That's Sarah Barzak with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy as we discuss the nuclear industry and its future with the collapse of nuclear projects in the Southeast. When we come back, we'll look at the last nuclear project still standing. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to our encore conversation on the nuclear industry in a moment here on Charlotte Talks. Support today comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, a full-service real estate investment company serving the Charlotte region for over 26 years. From purchase negotiations to renovations and managing the rental, Henderson is committed to its clients. InvestHP.com. And support comes from Taylor Richards & Conger, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Phillips Place next to Dean & DeLuca, details at trcstyle.com. The hacking of credit reporting agency Equifax has opened the door for identity theft and other cybercrimes against as many as 143 million Americans. It was the third cyber attack against the company in 2 years. Coming up in 20 minutes, On Point will have an update on the data breach and what can be done to shore up cyber defenses. That's coming up here on listener-supported public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
President Trump is threatening to cut off trade with any country doing business with North Korea.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Jennifer Roberts needed to defend her record. The challengers, Vi Lyles and Joel Ford, needed to show they are connecting to the average charlatan.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm David Borax, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of the nuclear power industry. Several projects around the Southeast have been canceled this summer because of construction issues, bankruptcy, and especially costs. Scott, you had a comment about Sarah's last statement.
Yes, I appreciate Sarah's comments about the decisions that Duke made in terms of the Levy facility. The construction of new nuclear units, obviously, as your entire program's about, is face challenges. But I would also like to point out that there are a number of utilities, and I believe Duke being one of those, that has been very responsible about how they approach the construction of new nuclear facilities, maintaining diversity, and then also looking at the ability to provide that long-term source of baseload generation. We approached construction of new nuclear very cautiously and carefully. We recognize the significant investment that it takes for a project like that. And as we've evaluated our options, looked at the demand for electricity, we do feel that license extension using nuclear is a more prudent approach at this point in time.
Kit, I wanted to go back to you quickly. What is Wall Street thinking about the cancellation of these projects? What does this mean for investors?
Wall Street is, when it comes to utility stocks, is risk averse. Obviously, the bankruptcy of Westinghouse sent a pretty major signal to everyone that there might be big question marks here about how you get these things done. So given that situation, a lot of investors say, hey, let's just try to cut our losses and get out of here, because the alternative is continuing the construction with an open pocketbook. And if you could be sure that we're spending another, say, three or five, or in Southern's case, $7 billion estimated to finish Vogtle, people would probably be very happy, people being investors. Now, all that said, there's also a big group of investors who say, well, utilities are different. Utilities, as Scott was saying, utilities have the obligation to serve. They're the monopoly. They must have power available 24/7, and they must have it at a reasonable price, or they're going to get hammered by their regulators appropriately. So they have to look beyond even the next year or two. And as I think Scott was suggesting, they're looking out to 2030 and thinking, okay, what do we do after that? It takes a long time to ramp these things up. And somebody in the 2030s is going to be living with those decisions, customers and management and investors. So it's not a simple answer, even on Wall Street, for sure.
Kit, we learned last week that the Southern Company is going forward with the Vogtle project after all. What does that mean for the future of the industry?
Well, for the industry, it's a hopeful sign after the shutdown of the summer project in South Carolina. It's obviously the only project underway. Obviously, the rest of the industry will be watching closely how successfully this gets done, whether it's physically done on time, whether financially it gets the support from the state, and its costs stay under control. And of course, investors will be watching very closely as well, how well Southern Company can handle a very large project that continues and that is estimated to cost them something like $7 billion more before the thing gets up and running.
I think the cost is maybe up to $25 billion now. Sarah?
Yes, the news is really shocking because Southern Company, in our opinion, doesn't have any sort of secret ingredient that other utilities didn't have. And the costs of this project now have more than doubled. And this Vogtle project has benefited from state handouts and federal handouts, and it's unclear how much more is going to be taken and required for customers. So this is a decision that really squarely puts a lot of pressure on the Public Service Commission to, for the first time ever, actually looking hard at how to protect customers because they've already suffered and it's not going to get any better anytime soon.
So we've talked a couple of times already about costs being a really big part of the equation on the decision to cancel these. And people are asking questions about what happened with the Summer plant in South Carolina and some of these other ones that are under construction around the country. The Summer plant was originally supposed to cost something like $9 million. By the time it was canceled, it was, well, I've heard estimates as high as $25 billion. So the big picture question, let me ask this of you, Avery. Why do plants like these end up costing so much more than expected? And what happened with the Summer plant?
I think a lot of the problem with this plant, based on testimony that was received at these investigative committees, one of the issues that came to light was that there was never a detailed construction schedule for this project or a detailed cost estimate based off of that schedule. And it was approved anyway by the state board that oversees utilities. Without that detailed construction schedule, it's difficult to keep the project online, to know when certain construction milestones are going to happen. And actually, at the point of abandonment, SCANA still didn't have one. You know, 10 years later, still had not actually gotten from Westinghouse, the now bankrupt contractor, a detailed construction schedule for the project. Anecdotally, you know, a lot of these employees who were fired, you know, immediately from the site, about 5,000 employees, as I said earlier, you know, most of them signed confidentiality
agreements.
Exactly, yeah. Most of them signed those agreements, so they can't speak. But anecdotally, some of them have said that there were tons of inefficiencies at the VC Summer site. You've got workers pushing around brooms while they await certain parts of models that haven't, or modules that haven't showed up. You know, we've heard of certain ones, certain employees, you know, fixing one part or laying some rebar, or pouring some concrete, and then having to wait several days for an inspector to come by and, you know, and approve it before moving on. Just a ton of inefficiencies that apparently, you know, according to testimony that everyone heard last week, manifested directly from this lack of a detailed construction schedule. And then another part of it is that under that 2007 law, SCE&G was allowed to come in whenever they wanted to, really update the construction timeline with the state board that oversees them. And as long as the project was on that schedule, according to that timeline filed with the PSC, they were guaranteed rate increases under state law. So they would come in right before they applied for the rate increase, and they would update the timeline. And so according to the state, they were on schedule. So that's sort of the whole process that enabled the cost overruns.
Is that like having a credit card with no limit?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, if the state law mandates that you be on time in order to get a rate increase, but you are allowed to manipulate the timeline however you like, I'd say that works out pretty well in your favor.
Sarah, you've also been a critic of the particular issue that Avery just mentioned about the project timeline. Say a little bit about what you guys have been saying with that. I think it's called the Integrated Project Schedule.
Right. Yeah, that's the detailed schedule that that SCANA with the VC Summer project lacked, and even Georgia Power or Southern Company with the Vogtle project. And that has been happening for years and years, as Avery pointed out. And in Georgia, there is a semi-annual, every 6 month sort of review process that happens. And there's somebody called an independent construction monitor that's hired by the Public Service Commission to report on the status of the project. And they get into a lot of details. And that's one benefit that Georgia has that South Carolina has not. But that person has been testifying every 6 months for years now that it is imprudent to be running the project without a fully resource-loaded integrated project schedule. And that is problematic because back in the 2008-2009 timeframe in Georgia, and it's similar to South Carolina, you know, utilities said, we can build this project for X amount at an X amount time frame. All four of these reactors in Georgia and South Carolina were supposed to be operational by now. All four should have been operational by April of this year, 2017, and that's obviously not happened. So when these utilities go to commissions and say, we're actively managing these projects, but then all of a sudden, you know, SCANA says to the South Carolina Legislative Investigative Committee, well, we never had one of these, and what we were told originally was just kind of a loose estimate. I don't agree with that. They went to these legislators asking for things like the Baseload Review Act and the Senate Bill 31 in Georgia, and said, we can build these things on time now, and we can build them on budget. And that was the promise made also to the ratepayers, and that has obviously been a false promise.
So both the Summer plant in South Carolina and the Vogtle plant in Georgia were using the AR-1000, which was a new reactor that was designed by Westinghouse. And this reactor was – it's something new in the market. So, you know, these were the first utilities to be using this on some of the first projects to be built in 20 or 30 years. How has the fact that this is new and the manufacturing processes were not streamlined yet, how has that affected what happened here? Who wants to answer that?
This is Sarah. I could start, and I'm happy for anybody to join in. And it's the AP-1000, Advanced Passive 1000, just to correct right. that. And you're right. This is a design that actually hasn't been built anywhere in the world. China is further along than any of the projects in the U.S., and maybe starting the AP-1000s there this year, we'll have to see. But that is also delayed. So the one of the things that came out when all these projects in the U.S. were proposed is that there may be supply chain issues because you hadn't built any new reactors in, you know, decades, so to speak. And this is a new design that uses some different technologies. And some of those fears did play out. But one of the biggest factors was just the lack of craft labor, the skilled labor that was needed that had to meet the stringent nuclear sort of construction code requirements. And that has been one of the biggest costs and drains at the Vogtle and VC Summer projects. So those are some of the biggest gaps that occurred.
I would agree with that. It's Kit. That those were obviously key factors. So the interesting question that I think the whole utility industry is approaching now is, what do you do about it going forward? One lesson is, if we didn't have enough craft labor and we didn't have a solid supply chain in place, maybe we better develop those things and not just let them atrophy, which would effectively mean no nuclear plants ever in the future. And I, you know, certainly people in the industry and a lot of investors would believe, and I guess some customers, that would be not a foresighted idea to just assume in the future all we're going to have is renewables and gas-fired plants. Tough call there.
Mm-hmm. Duke Energy CEO Lynn Good gave a speech in Asheville a few weeks ago, where she was asked if nuclear is dead. And, you know, she said that Duke and other companies are building plants again for the first time in 40 years, and these technologies haven't been fully tested, so there have been delays and all of that sort of thing that we've been talking about. Where plants are being built around the world, they're often what Good called sovereign projects built by governments. And, you know, why is that the case? Well, it's they're big, complex, and expensive projects, Good said, and it's really a foundational element to a power system. And she thinks it may be difficult for private investment to finance projects like these in the future. Is there a role for government in the future?
Well, we already have a fair amount of that. I think there's been news recently that Southern's been approaching folks in Washington to talk about the potential for expanding the federal loan guarantees for Vogtle. So, you know, I think there's already a very significant federal role. And, of course, the Tennessee Valley Authority operates and just finished, I think, a new nuclear plant. So a fair amount of that going on already. But there's a good point there that private investors may not want to take on the risk of a huge investment like a nuclear plant.
Avery, in South Carolina, one of those two utilities, Santee Cooper, which was building the summer plant, is actually state-owned. And since this project failed, there's been some discussion about whether the state could step in some way and help this. There's also been discussion about whether the state should sell Santee Cooper. Say a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, that's an ongoing debate right now amongst primarily centering around Governor Henry McMaster's efforts. I can't see, based on what lawmakers have said about the possibility of bailing out Santee Cooper or taking on its debt, lawmakers have said that would be a deal breaker. If any deal that involves South Carolina taxpayers taking on the losses of the VC Summer Project. However, there has been a great deal of discussion, however doubtful, about the possibility of selling pieces or all of Santee Cooper. All of that has been pretty a well-kept secret, I would say. There have been some companies that have already signed non-confidentiality agreements regarding that. So there hasn't been too much news that has come out of those discussions, but that seems to be the more plausible scenario, given that lawmakers are in no way interested in taking on that debt.
Scott, a quick question for you. As somebody who grew up in this industry, you worked as an engineer at the Oconee plant and early in your career, 30 years now. What are your thoughts about seeing what's happening with nuclear?
Well, in terms of a career in nuclear, it's been very rewarding for me personally and provided many opportunities. It's also been rewarding in terms of what I've seen it be able to provide to our communities in terms of just the commitment that folks have made that live in the communities and work at these facilities, but also in terms of what it provides to our communities as far as a reliable source of electricity.
Thanks very much, Scott. That's Scott Batson of Duke Energy. Kit Connellidge of Bloomberg Intelligence was with us, Sarah Barsack of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and Avery Wilkes, a reporter with the state newspaper. Thanks to you all. I'm David Borax, filling in for Mike Collins. This has been Charlotte Talks.